Let the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. In the late 1940s, an author named Shirley Jackson published a short story called The Lottery. I'm sure many of you have read it. It often gets assigned in high school and college. But if you didn't read it or you weren't paying attention in high school and college, the short story follows a plot. It's set in an unnamed village at an unknown time, and they're gearing up for this lottery, and they're wondering who it is that's going to get picked. And finally, the main character in the story discovers it's her that's been picked. She's the winner of the lottery. And the reader's wondering what is going to happen to this woman who's just won the lottery. And then the story takes a very dark turn, and we find that the winner of the lottery each year is actually stoned to death. And so as a reader, you respond to this and think, what kind of a barbaric people would tolerate something like this? That would actually approve of putting someone to death for no apparent reason. Who could do something like this? Who could tolerate it? But then we read our gospel text this morning and discover, maybe not quite to the same level, but discover that so often human beings, especially in the name of upholding traditions, keep life from flourishing. We see Jesus healing a woman who had been sick for 18 years, and the response of the religious authorities wasn't joy, wasn't happiness, wasn't delight, wasn't peace, but was indignation because this healing had happened on the Sabbath. So the question that I want to ask us this morning is, how can we avoid the temptation to impede the work of God in the name of our traditions? Because it happens. So we're in Luke chapter 13 today. We're on the journey with Jesus and his disciples from Galilee to Jerusalem, where the cross is waiting for Jesus. And along the way, he's teaching about discipleship. And as he goes, the opposition to Jesus becomes more and more intense. In this story today, Jesus, a rabbi, is teaching at a synagogue, as was his custom. And in the middle of the service, he notices a woman who, we read, had been afflicted by a spirit that kept her from standing straight. And this had happened for 18, this has gone on for 18 years. So for 18 years, this woman was not able to stand upright. And Luke identifies the problem as a spiritual problem. And this is often the case. Oftentimes when we're sick today and have physical ailments, we go to the doctor, and we should go to the doctor. But there is an element of our failing to thrive as human beings, and these are physical realities that are often at their core spiritual problems. Jesus recognizes that in this case, this woman has been bound not so much by a physical problem, but by a spiritual problem which has these physical consequences. And so Jesus speaks to the woman, "You are free from your ailment," and he goes and lays hands on her, and she's free. And her response? Praising God. She's joyful. She's ecstatic. For 18 years, she hasn't been able to stand up straight, and now here she is standing. But the response of the religious leader is indignation. Why, Jesus, are you doing what you know is wrong on the Sabbath? Hey, there are 6 days of the week where you can come and do this, but not on the Sabbath. You cannot heal on the Sabbath. The indignation is fierce. But Jesus, for the second time in 2 weeks, you remember last week he denounced his listeners as hypocrites because they weren't able to see the sign of the times. Today he says, "You hypocrites, look, you all, every Sabbath day, untie your ox or your donkey and lead the ox or the donkey to water." And so here's this woman who has been bound up for 18 years. And this is a daughter of Abraham, bound for 18 years. And you're indignant because now she's free. Now, notice that the crowds who are listening to Jesus responded to what Jesus was saying and wound up bringing shame on the religious leader. And this echoes the prophetic critique of religion in the Old Testament. Our passage today we heard from Isaiah 58 was a denunciation of how the people in the 7th century were practicing, 7th century BC, were practicing the Sabbath. That they were so concerned to get it right that they had completely glossed over the purpose of the Sabbath. And Isaiah calls them back to the purpose of the Sabbath. And I believe that some of us may read a story like this and say, well, the problem is the Sabbath. Just get rid of the Sabbath and you won't have these problems. But of course, that's not the solution. The solution isn't to get rid of the Sabbath, but the solution is to see the Sabbath for what it really is. And you find the answer to that question in the scriptures. And so you know that there are two places in the Old Testament where the Sabbath is commanded. In Exodus 20, we read the Ten Commandments, and then in Deuteronomy 5, we read the Ten Commandments. But it's interesting that in both of these texts, the rationale for keeping the Sabbath is different. In Exodus 20, we read that the people of Israel are to keep the Sabbath because in 6 days God created the heavens and the earth and rested on the seventh day. And so resting from work, abstaining from work on the Sabbath is to keep in tune, to live in sync with God's creative intention for humanity. This is good. This is a good thing. We should encourage this. But in Deuteronomy 5, when the Israelites are commanded to keep the Sabbath, the rationale is different. The rationale is this: for you were slaves in Egypt, and God set you free. And so the Sabbath is not only a day on which to live within the creative intention of God, but also to live life as a free people, as a people who have been redeemed from slavery and live in a free space. And the religious leader that Jesus was interacting with was so focused on abstaining from work on the Sabbath, he was all Exodus 20. Jesus was calling him to also look at Deuteronomy 5, which is the Sabbath as a day for free people. And we know this because Jesus uses the language of loosing and untying. So your donkey and your ox on the Sabbath day is bound. But each Sabbath day, you loose or you release your ox or your donkey so that they can go and drink water. And because if they don't drink water, they're going to die. And so in order to see life sustained and flourish, you untie, you unloose, you free your ox or your donkey so that they can thrive. You do this every single Sabbath day, Jesus is saying. What could be more appropriate then on the Sabbath for a woman who has been bound by the power of the devil for 18 years to be loosed, to be released, to thrive and to flourish? The Sabbath is a day of freedom. It's a day for free people. And this woman is now free. And so why would we not celebrate and rejoice with her, and even more with God, for the work that we see him doing on this day that we've set apart for him? So the answer, again, is not to get rid of the Sabbath because it's abused, but rather to go deeper into the meaning of the Sabbath itself. And we find that to live and observe the Sabbath means, on one hand, to abstain from work, and on the other hand, to celebrate freedom. Now, how does this apply to us today? Well, the truth is that the Sabbath is the only one of the Ten Commandments that American Christians feel free to break with impunity. Oh, you take a day off. Gosh, I'd love to take a day off, but I'm just so busy. oh, really? You don't get a ton of emails and text messages on the Sabbath? You must not be quite as important. Or maybe you're even just a little bit lazy because you take that 24 hours not to do anything. Gosh, I would really love to do that, but I'm just so busy, I'm so important. Imagine if someone did that about adultery. I'm really hoping not to commit adultery this year, but I'm just so attractive. The women, they just throw themselves at me. What am I going to do? Nobody does that. So if we want to live, or at least I don't know anybody who does that. If you do, invite them to church and we'll see what happens. All right, so back on track. We, as a people, really ought to think about Exodus 20 and its relation to keeping the Sabbath. But we also ought to think about Deuteronomy 5. Because when we gather together each week for worship, on one hand, it's a time that we've set aside to live within God's creative intention. And the order that God has established in creation is an order that we ought to live within for our own good. And so as Anglican Christians, we've set aside this time and this space, and we've ordered our worship in very thoughtful, very intentional, very important ways, and we ought to live within that. That's important. But on the other hand, there's Deuteronomy 5, and it reminds us that ultimately the Sabbath is a celebration of a free people. And so within the order that we've established for worship, there needs to be an emphasis on freedom. Because at the end of the day, that's the story of the gospel. It's a story of taking people who are bound by sin, bound by evil, and ultimately bound under the complete sway of the power of death. And we gather each week to remember that Jesus Christ came to set us free. And if we lose sight of the dynamic of freedom within our worship, then we're going to go down the path of the religious leader that Jesus had a hard time with in Luke chapter 13. One of the things that really breaks my heart when I talk to people in our congregation is a fear that sometimes comes across of doing something wrong. Because we do all this crazy stuff. We kneel, we bow, we cross ourselves, we come forward, we sit down, we stand up, all of that. I just don't want to do it wrong. Like if you did it wrong, something really bad would happen to you. But that's the road toward the religious leader in Luke 13, where we're bound by some sort of fear that we're going to do it wrong. Rather, we need to look at the rhythm and the practice and the participation in worship as a means to experience the freedom that God has given us in Jesus Christ. That ought to be the end point of our worship, the freedom that Jesus Christ has come to give us. If we forget that that's the end of the gospel, then inevitably we'll get so struck and stuck into Exodus 20 that we'll never go to Deuteronomy 5. So how does this work? Well, we've been looking at Jamie Smith's book, You Are What You Love, for the last couple of weeks. One more week of our discussion, you're welcome to come for that. But what Jamie says in one great sentence in the book is that worship is the heart of our discipleship if and only if worship is a repertoire of spirit-endued practices, okay, that grab our mind, grab our gut, recalibrate our cardia or our heart, and capture our imagination. And so as we go through the rhythm of the liturgy, what we're doing ideally is opening ourselves to the Spirit's work. The Spirit's work in the deepest parts of our guts, the heart which controls our will and our imagination that gives us grace to see what it is that God is doing? And do we understand and experience the rhythm of Sunday worship along those lines? Are we open to the Spirit working in and through each aspect of the liturgy, grabbing our gut, recalibrating our heart, and capturing our imagination? Worship is the heart of discipleship if and only if this is true. And I remember the story of Charles Simeon, who was a great Anglican leader in the early 19th century, and he had a crisis of faith when he was a student at Cambridge, because each student at Cambridge at that time was required to take communion 3 times a year. And Simeon wasn't particularly religious, but he took life very seriously, and he said, well, if I'm going to take communion, I ought to know a thing or two about it. And so he started to do some research and was overwhelmed with the reality of his sin and his need of grace. And so the confession preceding communion was a wake-up call for him to acknowledge his sin and his need of grace. And then the Eucharist became this outpouring of the presence of God in his life that changed him to the point where God raised him up to be one of the most significant leaders in the Anglican Church in the 19th century, and the fruit of his ministry is still present today. Those are the kinds of things that I believe God wants to do in the midst of our worship, as we open our hearts and our minds and our bodies and our imaginations to the work of the Spirit. I also find that as an individual, in addition to the individual dynamic that's at work within worship, there's a corporate dynamic as well, that we're aware of our brothers and sisters that are worshiping with us, and that we long for the freedom that this woman in Luke chapter 13 experienced for our brothers and sisters as well. And so we would never come at our brothers and sisters with a harsh word of saying you did it wrong, wagging our fingers. But rather, we want to help our brothers and sisters experience the freedom. And so we respond with prayer and with support and with encouragement. We listen to what's going on in our lives. We support and we walk with one another on this journey of freedom. And so within the order and our desire to live within God's creative intention, Exodus 20, we remember that this is a story and a celebration of a free people, Deuteronomy 5. So there's an individual dynamic, a corporate dynamic, but then there's also a global dynamic and a missional dynamic. And I'm reminded, Mark Labberton, who's the president of Fuller, wrote a very provocative book called The Dangerous Act of Worship. And in that book, he writes about experiences that he's had of praying during worship and becoming overwhelmed with the reality of suffering in the world. And as he's become overwhelmed with the reality of suffering in the world, he's gone from a place of worship to a place of mission. And that's one way that we know that worship is actually a part of the transformational process that God desires for each one of us. Are we becoming the kind of people who look at the world and see its pain and see its brokenness, and we desire to go and to announce with our words and our deeds the gospel of Jesus, the story of a free person who desires to live in accordance with God's creative intention? And when I see things, even in our own congregation, people looking at abandoned children, say, in our state, people who have been taken from their biological parents for very tragic reasons, and adopting and fostering, we see the fruit of a story that says, we were slaves, and now we're free. That the gospel works on our heart in such a way that we become keenly aware of the brokenness and suffering in the world, and know that the answer to that brokenness and suffering is what we've just been through in worship. The story of God who created the world and loved, but whose people rebelled. But through Jesus, he's led them from bondage into freedom. So that's what we see Jesus doing in Luke chapter 13. There's nothing wrong with the Sabbath. In fact, the Sabbath is a good thing. And we could all use a little bit more Exodus 20 in our lives. But we need to understand that the story of worship, the story of setting apart a time and a place for God, is not only a story of order and living within God's created intention, but it's also a story of freedom. It's also a story of liberation. And this is a context in which God, by His Spirit, wants to communicate with us, wants to move within us, wants to move among us, wants to work in and through us in such a way that we become the people that God has created us to be. A free people, having known that through the life, death, and resurrection, we have been marked as God's own people, and from this place sent into the world to be agents and ministers to remind the world and call the world to that same kind of freedom. Amen.